two presidents can communicate and can resolve problems, even when the lower levels of the two governments may not be doing so.
Can leadership chemistry lead to a good trade deal? It's Tuesday, April 16th. This is VOA Asia. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. We're glad to have you with us. Join us, too, on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also ahead, Indonesians prepare to vote, social discussions in South Korea and Australia. Crypto is growing in the Philippines. Violence against immigrant women and a steel wall. It's all on today's VOA Asia. U.S. Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin said on Saturday a U.S.-China trade agreement would go way beyond previous efforts to open China's markets to U.S. companies and hoped the two sides were close to the final round of negotiations. Mnuchin called the agreement under negotiation the most significant change in the trading relationship in 40 years, adding that it would have real enforcement on both sides. U.S. President Donald Trump has said many times that he relies on his personal relationships with the leaders of other countries, particularly the leaders of Israel, North Korea, and Chinese President Xi Jinping. VOA Asia's Ira Melman spoke with an advisor to the Trump administration. Michael Pillsbury is the director of the Center of Chinese Strategy with the Hudson Institute here in Washington. He is one who has told interviewers that China and the United States still face conflict in the future, but that the chemistry between their leaders will provide a buffer.
Well, I think it's very important that in China, President Xi Jinping is so powerful. He doesn't really face a Senate investigating him or political enemies who attack him in the press. So President Xi, therefore, has the power to reach an agreement with President Trump on trade issues. So, President Trump has a similar executive power when it comes to trade matters, not in all things, of course. But in trade matters, President Trump has a lot of authority for what this final trade agreement will look like. So my point is that the two of them have already established a good relationship. This is really a positive factor in trying to resolve the trade dispute, which otherwise could get out of control and either never be resolved or result in a breakdown of the talks and a great deal of tariffs being put on and other kinds of allegations, which would hurt the global growth rate.
A lot has been made of how much importance the U.S. president puts on his personal relationships. Do you think that really is? Well, obviously, you think that's the way to go, but why is it so important?
Well, I've read his 14 books, and in each of his books, President Trump describes in the first person. He says, I did this and I did that and I thought about this. He describes his decision-making process. And it always has to do with the character and the nature of the relationship he has with colleagues or rivals or people he's doing deals with. He's very much focused on being able to understand what the other person's character and temperament and goals are. Often very quickly. He gives many examples in these 14 books he's written. One of the most important things that's very little known about President Xi and President Trump is their phone calls. The exact number has not been revealed, but apparently it's as many as 30 phone calls between the two of them, sometimes lasting an hour, even with room for and time for interpretation. So the in-person meetings at Mar-a-Lago and then in Beijing and then in Buenos Aires, combined with this large number of phone calls, seems to me builds the foundation that the two presidents can communicate and can resolve problems, even when the lower levels of the two governments may not be doing so.
The administration came out on Friday saying that it does look like there is a deal probably at hand. What do you know about that, and what can you talk about?
Well, I think the administration and President Trump have been very careful not to say that there's a deal at hand. They've been very careful to say a great deal of progress has been made. Sometimes they will say 90%. But President Trump himself is very careful to say there's no deal, and if there's no deal, there's no summit. So we have to be careful in hearing the words progress and, you know, things being impressive, but always qualified, that there's no final deal and there are still some very nasty issues left to resolve.
Such as?
Well, the president and his spokesman have been talking a lot about the enforcement problem, this extremely difficult issue of suppose my negotiating partner is not telling the truth and is only making a claim that they will do their best, you know, to reduce theft or all the other issues. And then something happens where an American company comes in and says, no, our trade secrets are still being stolen. We don't have access to the Chinese market. There are all kinds of restrictions put on us. So the Chinese have violated the agreement. Then what happens after that is the part that's still not officially fully resolved yet. There's been some progress, the president and his advisors have said. There will be an appeal mechanism. It will meet periodically to listen to complaints. And ultimately, the top two people, Ambassador Lighthizer and Vice Premier Liu He, will decide what kind of punishment to administer for violations. But then how that punishment will be applied and whether there can be retaliation if the other side doesn't agree, that seems to still be in doubt. That's a sticking point.
Pillsbury adds that the controversial issue of tariffs placed by the United States on Chinese products has been effective, a stance that is not held by many economists. These are among some of the top Asia stories that you'll find right now when you visit voanews.com. Australian media companies face contempt charges. Philippines edges back into U.S. alliance as new friend China stirs anger. Former U.S. House Speaker says rest of world should be more like Taiwan. Chinese dissidents remember liberal reformer Hu Yaobang. Can Vietnam cities ban two-wheel transport? Expanded coverage of all these stories and much more are, of course, on Facebook at VOA Asia. You can also stop by the voanews.com website. VOA Asia continues. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Former General Prabowo Subianto desperately wants to be the next president of Indonesia. His failed bid 5 years ago has not deterred him, and he is campaigning with a ruthless gusto backed by firebrand Islamic clerics and nationalists. Yet his strategy to oust the incumbent, President Joko Jokowi Widodo, is struggling, especially in an electorate where mundane issues like transport and getting the kids off to school will hold far greater significance when ballots are cast tomorrow. Reports on the rising number of jihadists, including the Center for Strategic and International Studies, which says the number had quadrupled since 9/11, are worrying. And there are concerns in Indonesia about ISIS fighters returning from Syria and the Middle East. Greg Barton, chair of Global Islamic Politics at the Alfred Deakin Institute for Citizenship and Globalization in Australia, said the number of jihadists in Indonesia has increased, especially in the countryside, where a harsher brand of Islam is often promoted. But he added their numbers were measured in the thousands and that they were not a threat in the current election climate, which in a population of 264 million people is being dictated by economic growth and development.
They are planning to the longer term to try and change legislation and try and get through some more agreeable Islamic legislation. That's a real threat because it means that principles of liberal democracy can be slowly eroded and die the death of a thousand cuts. But the reality is on Wednesday, they won't be major players.
President Joko Jokowi Widodo appears to be ahead in the polls. Barton said all the polls suggest Jokowi should win comfortably. Our thanks to Luke Hunt in Jakarta for contributing this story. Happening now in Asia, the operator of Japan's Fukushima nuclear power plant began removing fuel rods Monday from one of the three reactors that melted down in 2011. The operation is more than 4 years behind schedule. The work is being managed remotely because of high radiation levels still present inside the building. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're glad you're with us today on VOA Asia. A top South Korean court ruled this past week that the country's criminal ban on abortion is unconstitutional. As VOA's Bill Gallo reports from Seoul, that ruling means the 66-year-old law could be nullified by the end of next year.
South Korea is one of very few developed countries with an anti-abortion law. That's in large part because of an influential evangelical Christian community. But polls have shown women, especially young women, support greater abortion rights. Bae is a Seoul resident in her late 30s. She says she thinks it's a positive, as giving birth to a child determines a woman's life, and from now on, a woman can make such an important decision by herself. Choi Ji-un is a South Korean commentator who supports women's rights. She says restricting women's self-determination rights and punishing women as well as doctors intimidates them. She says it's a positive change that these acts will be abolished. Under the current law, women who have abortions can be fined or imprisoned for up to a year. Doctors could be jailed for up to 2 years. In reality, the law was rarely enforced. The ruling gives lawmakers until the end of 2020 to change the law. If they can't do it by then, the ban will end.
Bill Gallo from Seoul. One of Australia's most high-profile athletes, the rugby union star Israel Folau, is facing dismissal following online comments that homosexuals and other sinners would not go to heaven. Rugby authorities say in the absence of compelling mitigating factors, they intend to terminate the contract of the 30-year-old Folau, who has played 73 international matches for his country. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
Israel Folau is one of Australian rugby's most highly paid and talented players, but he's also its most controversial. The star fullback is facing dismissal following an Instagram post in which he said hell awaits gay people, as well as drunks, fornicators and atheists. He also sent a tweet criticising the Tasmanian Parliament after it became the first Australian state to make it legally optional to list gender on birth certificates. The devil has blinded so many people in this world, Folau, a devout Christian, wrote online. Former Australian rugby international and author Peter Fitzsimons says Folau's time is up.
When you put that kind of stuff in the public domain, when you've got teen suicide rates of troubled teens troubled about their sexuality, there is a case to answer to say you can do that, but not be a part of rugby. You can't. We're not going to put you in a jersey. We're not going to put you on the posters. We're not going to pay you $1 million or $2 million when you're trashing everything we stand for. From the moment he put that up, it was the end.
Folau escaped sanction following homophobic comments he made a year ago. But it seems that Australian rugby bosses have had enough and are expected to rip up his contract. Born in Sydney to Tongan parents, Folau has said previously that his faith was far more important than his career. Influential Australian broadcaster Alan Jones, a former coach of the Australian International Rugby Union team, said if Folau's contract was terminated, it would be a slippery slope for free speech. But rugby bosses said in a statement that while the outspoken player was entitled to his religious beliefs, the way in which he has expressed them was inconsistent with the values of rugby. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Coming up, money you can't see or hold is becoming more valuable. You're listening to VOA Asia.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
This news from VOA Asia, the former Speaker of the U.S. House of Representatives, Paul Ryan, says the U.S. wants the rest of the world to be more like Taiwan, praise that will likely anger Beijing, which has long been sensitive to cooperation between the U.S. and the democratically governed island that China claims as its own. Visit VOA Asia Facebook for more details that you can share. This is VOA Asia. As VOA Asia continues, cryptocurrency exchanges are growing in the Philippines, despite a downturn last year in the value of the virtual currencies due to growing popular demand and lenience among regulators. Authorities in the developing Southeast Asian country have permitted at least 29 exchanges of cryptocurrency, following three that the central bank said it had approved last week, according to the domestic media reports. That count, which is high for Asia, follows a total of 10 exchanges permitted by the central bank. These exchanges feed into the development of a fast-growing financial technology or fintech sector in the Philippines, says Jonathan Rivales, chief marketing strategist with Banco de Oro Unibank in Metro Manila.
Fintech appears to be very advanced in the Philippines. They eventually look at the mobility of having it in mobile wallets, gives them flexibility to use money.
Cryptocurrency, most notably its standard bearer Bitcoin, became an investment vehicle in much of the world about a decade ago. But a 70% drop in Bitcoin prices last year weakened enthusiasm for crypto overall. Filipinos generally pick more traditional investments, such as equities, Rivella says, but young companies are eyeing cryptocurrency to raise capital, a process called initial coin offerings. 7 in 10 Filipinos have no bank account, he adds, so virtual currency gives those consumers a new option for making payments. That population would be able to jump on a currency source that's open to anyone and transparent because of its online transaction ledger called the blockchain. The central bank governor may see the cryptocurrency trade as part of his bigger plan to advance the country's electronic payment systems, according to analysts. Christian de Guzman is vice president and senior credit officer with Moody's Sovereign Risk Group in Singapore.
A certain segment of the population is certainly very technically sophisticated. It probably goes towards those efforts at facilitating electronic payments. I think that's the key point.
The Philippines, although much later than East Asia in picking up cryptocurrency, would eventually stand out if regulators embrace rather than restrict it. China and South Korea have placed curbs on certain types of crypto trade. Both banned initial coin offerings in 2017, and China ordered the closure of cryptocurrency exchanges as part of that move. South Korea has at least 21 exchanges. Japan is widely seen as Asia's most liberal place for cryptocurrency. The country has let 17 exchanges fully register, and that overtook China in 2017 as the biggest Bitcoin market in the world with 58% of the global volume. Japan declared Bitcoin legal tender in 2017. Exchanges contacted for this report declined comment. Our thanks to Ralph Jennings in Taipei for contributing this report. This news from VOA Asia. It's been 3 decades since the death in 1989 of former prominent party official and Chinese liberal reformer Hu Yaobang, which triggered mass student demonstrations. Those rallies ultimately led to the bloody Tiananmen crackdown in June, known later as the June 4th Massacre. All the big stories come your way through the day on VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, 40 red dresses hang outside the National Museum of the American Indian here in Washington. They're present 24 hours a day in all weather to draw attention to the plight of missing and murdered indigenous women who experience violence at a much higher rate than non-indigenous women. The dresses are part of an exhibit being presented in the United States for the first time, as VOA's Julie Tabo has more.
The empty red dresses snap furiously in a wicked wind, commanding attention. There's 40 of them on display outside of the National Museum of the American Indian in Washington. Each dress represents a missing or murdered indigenous woman.
So at the beginning of the project,
the installation is the creative brainchild of visual artist Jamie Black, whose goal is to raise awareness about the high rate of violence against Native women.
What I do is I put up empty red dresses in public spaces so that people can connect to the absence of these women, but also to the power and presence of the women through the red dress.
On this freezing day outside the museum, Black pays homage to the women the dresses represent in a special performance.
I really wanted to use my talents and my gifts to further the voices of a lot of people who are silenced. And indigenous women are really facing, this epidemic of silence.
Her choice of the color red was deliberate.
You know, it's our sacred lifeblood. It's like where our vitality comes from and our energy and our power as human beings. But it's also kind of an allusion to the violence and the loss of that sacred lifeblood through violence.
She calls her installation the Redress Project, or the Redress Project.
Redress is a word that means to put right a wrong. And Indigenous women have been facing injustice in North America for hundreds of years.
What are you doing? Your sister's under attack!
But more and more Native women are refusing to be silenced and are becoming proactive.
I think in these ways, in these movements like Standing Rock and Idle Demora, we see the strength of Indigenous women to, you know, maintain culture in the face of, such colonial violence.
I am very, very proud and honored to serve.
Black and other supporters are also encouraged by the presence of two Native American women in Congress now.
I think the 2019 Congress for Women was exceptional in the numbers that we now have in Congress, but for Native people, having two Indigenous women represent Kansas and New Mexico is obviously something we've not seen before, and hopefully we'll be able to bring attention to Native issues.
In the meantime, Black hopes the red dresses will have an impact on all who get to see them.
What I think the artwork and creativity can really do is really hit people in the heart. You know, people who walk by those dresses, they can't unsee that. You know, that's going to sit in their memory for a very long time. And I think it has a really emotional impact on people even before they know, what the dresses are even there for.
Julie Tabo, VOA News, Washington.
A wall on New York's Ellis Island that honors immigrants is almost at full capacity. Ramon Taylor tells us that to date, 770 panels are engraved with the names of almost 800,000 immigrants, including arrivals who never disembarked at Ellis Island.
While many of those memorialized at the American Immigrant Wall of Honor made the journey from Europe to Ellis Island a century ago, families from Central America and Southeast Asia, immigrant groups who arrived in larger numbers after the processing station shut its doors in 1954, may find their names engraved in steel, too.
Everybody wants to be honored. They want to be remembered. They want their moment of arrival in America to be something that is memorialized. And in a small way, that's what we can do here.
The diversity of names today reflects the country's changing immigration trends. What began as a fundraising tool to restore and maintain Ellis Island in 1987 has grown to 775,000 names across 770 panels, overlooking the Statue of Liberty and New York's Lower Manhattan. For $150, any immigrant or descendant of immigrants who wishes to add their family's name can do so. Visiting the wall where her great-grandparents are honored, Erin Josen says the difficulties that earlier immigrants faced should give hope to recent arrivals.
If I was a first or second generation, I would feel like, wow, these people can do and go through all this adversity and all this hardship, like the screenings, being judged, being told, like, we don't want you here. But yet they are able to grow families and have third, fourth, fifth generation.
International tourists marvel at the diversity of Ellis Island's National Museum of Immigration, even if they don't have family honored there that they know of.
It's good that everything is documented, that they have written notes of all these names. It should help lots of Americans retrace their ancestors and their roots.
According to the foundation, nearly every nationality is represented across these panels. Also included, slave laborers who were forced to migrate.
We tell the story of slaves and their arrival. That was a terrible situation, terrible tragedy. But they are now part of America and American history and American and the way America is. And they should be honoring their families here just as everybody else does.
Some of the country's indigenous population, American Indians, have also chosen to honor their families on the wall. Ramon Taylor, VOA News, Ellis Island.
You've been listening to VOA Asia. We'd like to say hello to everyone who is listening on Falcon Radio at Adamson University in the Philippines. We're glad that you're with us today. Come back and listen again tomorrow. You can find our program on iTunes and SoundCloud as well. Of course, we're on VOA Asia Facebook every day, streaming our program. And you can find past programs at voanews.com. We'd like to thank our director, Tracy Carter, engineer, Nelson Lopes, managing editor, Diane Gao, Skylar Ogden, Ira Melman, Keith Lane, and Anna Cook on our VOA Asia team. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. Have a nice day.